Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, it's Wednesday, so looking at the list of the yard sites this week, and the one I can zero in, have something to say about it, is someone not so well known at all, Rabbi Yitzchak Volozhiner, the son of Chaim Volozhiner. Everybody's heard of Chaim Volozhiner, obviously. I assume most of the people listening to this have heard of Chaim Volozhiner. But I don't think so many people know about his son. All these people are very interesting, but, you know, some people get the limelight and others less so. This is often the fate of those who have the fortune or the misfortune to be the son of great men. So, you know, the guy will never have any identity of his own. He'll always be the son of somebody else, like the Vilna Gaon's son, you know, or his brother or something like that. There are people like that, but all we know him is the Vilna Gaon's son or the Vilna Gaon's brother or cousin. But to get to our story, Chaim Volozhiner is somebody who made it, he was born in 1780 and died in 1849. So think about that. It's the late 1700s, early 1800s, first half of 1800s. Very stormy, very interesting period, and very complicated period in Jewish history, Eastern European Jewish history. This is the period when the old kingdom of Poland that I've spoken about before, the good old kingdom of Poland, was swallowed up by the Tsarist Russian Empire. That is the new Metzias. We talk about Russian Jewry. I've said many times here that there's no such thing as Russian Jewry. They're the provinces of Poland that were taken over by the Russians, starting in 1772 and later in the 1790s. So in other words, when Rabbi Yitzchak Volozhiner was growing up, this means the new reality is the Russians. So understand, Jews living in what we call today Lithuania or Belarus, but it was at that time a Polish territory where the guys with power, the local nobles, are all Polish. But now it's coming under the regime from Russia, from St. Petersburg, from the Tsars. That's a very complicated set of relationships I mentioned. And then you got to do with the Jews. If he's born in 1780, that means he was 17 years old when the Vilna Gaon died. So probably he met the Gra, you know. I'm just saying, give you a perspective of what's going on over here. Because Chaim Volozhiner, as everybody knows, was very close with the Vilna Gaon. And the town of Volozhin itself is not really that far. So here's somebody who saw the Gra. What's really interesting is that we're told Rabbi Yitzchak Volozhiner, let's put it this way, this touches, was a maskil of, if you know what I mean by that, not what you think. This is the story, as I sometimes put it, of the Haskalah that never was. The Lithuanian Jews, the Misnagdim and all that, contrary to popular belief, had a weak spot, a openness to Haskalah. By that I mean things other than just Gemara. Of course, it goes without saying, 95%, 98% is Gemara. But there's room, like in the Renaissance, you know, for 2%, 3%, 5%, whatever, 8%, for things that are other than Gemara. And it's the attitude that even the Vilna Gaon is like that a little bit. And it's the attitude that says, the more you know about the world, the more you understand about the Bria, the better it is. You want to have a broad mind education, even though there's no question of the primacy of Gemara. That's what I mean by the Haskalah that never happened because, in the lifetime of Rabbi Yitzchak Volozhiner, it sort of happened and then didn't. The story of his life is the story of a Haskalah that might have developed. I would call it a from Haskalah. But then things got totally screwed up and it didn't develop. And instead you have a very bitter enmity between the from world on one hand and the Haskalah on the other. Today, most of you don't even know what I'm talking about. If you say the word Haskalah, you immediately think of some anti-from things like reform or whatever. And it wasn't particularly in the beginning. So if he's born in 1780, just think, you know, he's in 1800, he's 20 years old. He's growing up in what we call today the Napoleonic period. Napoleon invaded Russia in 1812. He went out of business in 1815 after the Battle of Waterloo. This when Bitzel was like 35 years old. These are formative years. And this was a time when, yes, there was a Hasidic movement growing by leaps and bounds. The Hasidic movement was not seen as something positive by the circles we're talking about. These were the Misnagdim. Although Reb Chaim Volozhin was no way as anti-Hasidic, no way as the Vilna Gaon, obviously. He had good relations with them in some degree. And Reb Yitzchak Witzel, as they called him, was at one point wanted to be a doctor. He was interested in science. He learned French and Polish. You see, through tutors. These are not what you associate necessarily with a person that's going to be Rav Shiva Volozhin. And I'm not sure in his early youth this was exactly the career that he planned for himself, although that is the career that turned out. He became the rabbi in the city and the town. I was there. And in the Rosh Yeshiva of the yeshiva after his father died in 1821. So here's somebody who ran the yeshiva for close to 30 years, from 1821, let's say, to 1849. It's 28 years, which is a piece of, an interesting piece of time. Now, as I said before, the idea of a broader knowledge other than just Gemara, in and of itself, was not necessarily treif. I'll just give you an example. Who's against math? You see, there's nothing from or not from about math, about arithmetic, about algebra, geometry, and things like that. We all know that Vilna Gaon himself wrote a book on geometry. So the fact that it is not just classic Torah learning doesn't in and of itself make it treif. On the other hand, there are other types of non-Gemara subjects which are intrinsically, ideologically, hostile, or at least challenging. So there's a big difference between math, for example, on the one hand, and philosophy, for example, on the other hand. Or if it's the early 19th century, history, the study of the Jewish past, which is beginning in the early 19th century, and it's bringing a Western perspective, which is very skeptical and historicist about the stories in the Bible and the Talmud and all that kind of business. That's already a different kettle of fish. That's already, that the secular subject itself is one which is, shall I say, anti-fundamentalist, anti-nomian, and therefore will be hostile, and to use English, to make the kids unfrom. So this is the world in which this person is growing up. He lived to be almost 70, so the first half of his life is up to the end of Napoleon, and the second, the last 35 years or whatever, close to that, is after Napoleon. Now, how does things go? Nobody knows exactly why Reb Chaim Volozhin started the Volozhin Yeshiva around 1802 in the middle of the Napoleonic era, but that's what happened. Reb Chaim died, I think, in 1821. So the son took over at a time when we find, I remember this, the number one Moscow in Russia was Levinson, and he published a book like Hatu'udah or something like that, which was advocating what I just said before, an openness to things other than Gemara, although not in a way that would hurt the Jewish religion. Now, to be perfectly honest, this guy Levinson was anti-from, but he pretended not to be. And he got Haskamas on that Sefer, is it Hatudah Yisrael or something like that? He got Haskamas from the biggest rabbis. You see, I remember the Rav in Vilna, Ababa Paskal, and people like that. It's funny, it's surprising. One thinks of people like Rav David Luria and others who were big Gaonim at that time, who has secular education somehow or other. It doesn't exactly fit our picture that we have of an Eastern European rabbi. There's all types. Now, in addition to what I just said, we have to throw in the Russian component, because the fact is that once you finish 1815, so for the next 100 years, Poland and Belarus was handed over to the Tsars of Russia. It became part of the Russian Empire. I've spoken about this a little bit before by Yitzhak Lachon and others. This was a tricky business because the Russian Empire was a dictatorship. Autocracy is the technical term. But the Tsar, in St. Petersburg, I mean, he didn't spend all day long, reading every line and pointing every dog catcher. He created an army of bureaucrats. And these bureaucrats, governors, administrative officials, and whatever, ran the empire. The nature of bureaucrats, Russian bureaucrats in the 19th century, is you want to make sure everybody's Russian. So what do you do with all the Polaks and all the Belarusians and the Ukrainians and the Jews and the Lithuanians, the other? You want to erase as much as possible their cultural uniqueness and get them to blend into Russians. You see, they're white. They're not black, as I always say. They're not Asian, so they don't stand out. So if you convert them, either culturally or religiously, then they're part of you. So you just added them to your strength. That is the mentality of the Russian bureaucracy, and therefore they were hostile on many levels to the Jews and to Jewish culture, because the Jews were numerous. They were growing in the 1800s by leaps and bounds. Jewish population, people don't know this, in the Russian Empire, which is the Polish province of the Russian Empire, increased by millions in the 1800s. You hear that? They had a baby boom of unprecedented proportions. I'm not exactly sure why. So the Jews are all over the place in these provinces. They usually controlled the economy because the people at the stores and the businesses and the merchants and all that kind of stuff usually were Jewish. The Jewish are very clannish. They talk Yiddish. They have solidarity, hang among each other. And you had an ocean of autonomous coercive communities, the Kahillas of old, which in the beginning of the 1800s still had the power of a death penalty and things like that. You know, the strong autonomy. And from the Russian point of view, it's a state within a state, and it's a hostile people. Now, really, 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 the Russians were stupid. The Frum Jews are the last ones who want to get involved in politics. The Frum Jews say like this, just the Tsar should leave us alone, and we'll be loyal to him. I'm serious. I'm not being funny. You know, just tell us what you need for tax-wise and otherwise, and let us live our lives of cultural insularity. Had the Tsars listened to that, they would have had a lot less trouble. But they were a bunch of fools. I'm talking about Alexander I, Nicholas I, and Alexander II, Alexander III, and Nicholas II. These are the five or six people that ruled Russia from 1800 down to the First World War, when the Russian royal family was just liquidated by disgruntled, subjects. And during the 1800s, they tried to make Russia as homogeneous as possible. And I'm skipping over the other nationalities. As far as the Jews are concerned, they thought this is just terrible. What they wanted is the Jews to stop dressing Jewish, stop talking Jewish, and if possible, stop being religiously Jewish. Can't you convert them all? Now, the first Tsar in the 1800s was Alexander I. It was Tsar from 1801 to 1825. So this would be the first, 45 years over Yitzhak Mevolozhin. So for the first 45 years of his life, it was bad enough. But the regime didn't poke too much into the local Jewish communities. It was clear that the government is hostile. At that time, it wasn't too hard to bribe the local Russian administrators. The Russian regime was mainly interested in suppressing the Poles and the others and incorporating as much as possible into Russia. It was clear from the government's point of view that the Jews are considered a negative element. They wanted the Jews to become farmers and peasants. Yeah, right. The bureaucrats didn't want to become farmers and peasants, but they want the Jews to, because they liberate them. You know, it's good for you, but it's not good for me. It's all, the whole Russia was run on lies. It really was run on lies. And that's Russian history, but I'm not going to go into that. And therefore, you know, there were just commissions and other government laws passed that always were causing trouble for the Jews. But when he, at the age of 45, for the last 25 years of his life, things got much worse. Because in 1825, the Tsar died and his brother took over for the next 30 years. That's Tsar Nicholas I, who was the Tsar of Russia from 1825 to 1855. 30 years. He was a mamzer shen kamo. He made the others look good. And under Nicholas I, he was a narrow-minded autocrat who was determined that shouldn't be even the slightest diminution of his dictatorship powers, shouldn't be in the slightest possibility of the people below having some ideas of their own and wanting some kind of political development. He really turned on a very heavy dictatorship, which was stupid because it means all the other countries in Europe were moving slowly but surely towards a democracy and a stable system. In Russia, they doubled down on the autocracy and the dictatorship, and it just made it that Russia's really a police state. That's what they kind of invented, that term there. And if you push too hard, you get a pushback. That's when the terrorism started. That's when the rebels against the Tsarist regime commenced during the reign of Nicholas I. During his time, he really crushed them. But after his time, the terrorism grew by leaps and bounds and complicated the Tsarist regime and destroyed it eventually. So Nicholas I just didn't get that. Instead, he wanted a place like Prussia under Frederick the Great, where it's absolute obedience by everybody at all times. And you look at all the Jews, he He hated the Jews. He was an anti-Semite. He hated the Jews. There's a famous story that I think I told you this. He passed through the Jewish provinces in Lithuania somewhere, and all the Jews came out to greet him and acclaim him. And instead of being turned on by this demonstration of loyalty, he said, "Oh my God, how many people with black beards and, payas? It's disgusting. I didn't realize we had so many Jews. We got to do something about it." It's also true, by the way, he said, "How come the Jewish girls are so pretty? The men are so ugly and the girls are so pretty." He couldn't cop that. I always thought that's interesting. Anyway, from the time he became the Tsar in 1825-1826 until he died, you could regard this as a continual war by the regime against traditional Judaism and the Jewish population, with the intention of the regime to ultimately convert the Jews, but in the long term, in the short term, get rid of the old Jewish culture, get rid of the Jewish nomianism, the Jewish autonomous course of communities, and the Jewish cultural insularity. And by that I mean get rid of Frumkeit. So at one stroke of a pen, like in 1827 or 8, he abolished the autonomous course of communities. He just issued a decree. From now on, the Jewish communities don't have the right to coerce anybody, weakening their economy. Now, the guy wasn't liberal. He was a real dictator. But he wanted the Jews not to have power among themselves. Then, little by little, he passed all kind of laws in which he tried to stop the Jews from keeping mitzvahs. It's really like a story from, the fairy tales. But it really happened in the 1800s. The most egregious, he passed a law that you have to pay extra taxes to have Shabbos lights, candles for Friday night, to try to put that out because he knew how much Shabbos is a big part of Judaism. He launched mamish, a physical war against shekels. You probably don't know this. Once upon a time, the Litvisha women, the Misnagdim, did like Satmar. They used to shave the head and then put a shekel on. That was like universal. We think it's only a Hasidic custom. No, it was a universal custom. There's a book out there where the guy describes in Hebrew in great detail the campaign by the police and the government under Nicholas I to strip shekels off of women in the street and compel them to not cover their hair, because he considered that to be a primitive and anti-modern business. It's a little bit like, it's not the same thing, but it's a little bit like the French banning the burqa. That's how they saw it. And similarly, he did pass laws in the Russian Empire and enforced them that the Jews can't dress Jewish. Once again, you'll be surprised to hear that the Litvaks and the others also dress like the Hasidim with the Strymel and all the rest of it once upon a time. These were old Polish dress styles that were universal throughout the old kingdom of Poland, including Lithuania. And Nicholas I broke it. They went through the street and everybody dressed like that. They chopped their ear off or things like that, beat them up. They really enforced police laws. It's too long of a story to go into. But that's why the Litvaks, started dressing a little more Western. Even passed laws saying you have to adopt the German style of dress or the Russian style of dress, but you can't have the Jewish style of dress. And the Jews, by and large, pick the Russian style of dress, and that's why the Chabad Chaim wears that funny little hat, and that sort of thing, something you never saw in Hasidic territory. That's why the Lubavitchers, by the way, can't dress like the other Hasidim with the Strymels. They dress, with the other hats and spodiks and things like that, because these laws were enforced in Lubavitch land and in White Russia and Belarus, which is part of the Russian Empire. And there are many others. The worst, of course, I think everybody knows, was the Cantonists. It was Nicholas I who made this business where Jews now have to be part of the army, and every Jewish community has to supply recruits. And by the time the ugly process is over, it's little kids, usually the poor, the helpless, the orphans, and the others. And, not anybody with protection. And this was a tremendous Chil Hashem. And he made sure that these kids are in the army for 25 years, and they will convert somewhere along the way. Very few were able to not convert. There are many laws about this. Now, I'm only telling you to set the background. This is the last 20, to be exact, the last 24 years of the life of Britzel Volozhin. This is what he had to run into. He, like I said before, despite the fact that he was interested in secular studies, 99% of the time was learning. And so he turned out to be a big Talmud Chacham. I don't know how to compare him to his father, but he was a big deal. What's really interesting is, just like Reb Chaim, he was a big diplomat.
So all the Litvaks, if I can use that term, of the Russian Empire considered him to be the Gadol Ador. That's interesting, I just said. Usually we have a lot of fights. But there was no question at the time of Chaim Belozhiner, all the Rabbonim and all the communities looked him to be the leader. And when he died, his son Reb Yitzchak occupied the same position. So he must have been a very impressive person. Number one, as a Talmud Chacham. And number two, as a, a diplomatic, a manhig. Because all the communities said, he's the man and he's the one we should follow. And they intuitively realized that you have to have some leader against the government. The policies of the government after 1825 was a continuous pressure against the Jews. Now, this moved by Madrigas. By the time you get to the 1830s and after that, the government zeroed in on the fact that the way to go against Judaism most successfully was, like the Gemara says, Ein Tiyashim and Gedoyim, that you close down the cheders and you close down the yeshivas. Close down the cheders and close down the yeshivas. If you get rid of the chinuch system, then get rid of traditional Judaism, which is the plain truth. Now, how are you going to do that? Well, one way is to just go down and close every cheder in the country. They did try things like that, but the Jews, through passive resistance, you know, you bribe the local guy not to look, and the Voloshin Yeshiva, frankly, was officially closed down somewhere in the 1820s, and they bribed somebody to look the other way. This is this crazy business called the normal way of living in Tsarist Russia. So imagine you're a Yitzhak Voloshin, and you have to hold the fort. He would rove after his father in the town, and he was the, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Voloshin Yeshiva, which, as I think everybody knows, was the highest yeshiva in the Eastern Europe, among the Nachasidim, arguably even more. And that means that you attracted the best guys to learn there. And that means he has to give shiurim. And he must have been a giant Talmud Chacham. He left nothing in writing, so we don't know. But how could you be the Rosh Yeshiva for 30 years and just occupy a sinecure, you know, that you just do it because of your father? He obviously was a Balak Bar Hachi himself. And the result, the impression I get, me, myself, and I, from reading anything about him, or a little bit he left over, a little bit of him in writings, Pirkei Avos and things like that, is he's a very normal middle person, extremely responsible, extremely balanced. This is what we call a manhig, you know what I mean? Ish aloida. You know, he's like doing crazy to the right, nothing crazy to the left. And he suffered, I mean, he had the misfortune of living under Nicholas I. And so when the government ratcheted up and started drafting the kids and kidnapping, what are you going to do? When the government says you got to change the clothes and all that, what can you do? And when the government goes after the cheders and the yeshivas, oh my goodness, what do you do? Nicholas, during this period, the government of Nicholas I, in an intelligent effort to undermine from Yiddishkeit, what they did was they made a survey to the Jewish community and they discerned that many of the local maskilim, not all, but many of the local maskilim, were people who really had it out for the frum community. The closest I can come, because they on certain principled grounds, since I'm talking to an American audience, today the best way for me to explain it is, think of these guys in New York who told on the state of New York about the fact that in Hasidic yeshiva is the only place they have no English. Now, why are they doing that? In their mind, they're doing because the kids are being shortchanged, you know, in Satmar and places like that. They're not getting any English education. And you can never persuade the Hasidim. So the only way to do it is use the power of New York State to come down upon them and force them. And therefore, they don't consider themselves to be Malshinim or Mosrim, obviously. They consider themselves to be enlightened, critics who are using the army of government to benefit the young children who now will get a secular education. You all know what I'm talking about. There was this whole blow-up last month, 2 months, it spilled over into the regular yeshiva world. So this is what we're talking about in Russia. They went to the different maskilim, and as they say, a fair number of them were exactly the type I just mentioned. The reason is because the definition of a maskil is somebody who did not have a secular education, not a formal one in schooling, but resented that fact and became an autodidact. They taught themselves. They acquired, however they acquired, whatever secular education they picked up, some more and some less, and were very bitter at the system and considered the system to be corrupt and bad for the Jewish people in their mind. And they were totally willing to cooperate with the state, the czarist state, to get rid of the old system, including the yeshivas and all the rest of it, and replace it with something better. What would be something better? If the government would say we want Christian schools, they couldn't go along with them, because that'd be open treason. What the government did in consulting with the maskilim was to say like this: how about setting up a whole bunch of maskilic schools? Replace the cheders with, I use Baltimore terminology, even though it's not exactly the right way to do it, but I'll use it anyway. Replace the cheders with betefila. You know, that sort of thing, in which is not exactly against the traditional Judaism, not formally, but on the other hand, the education will be one in which traditionalism will be very much understressed, and secular and certainly non-fundamental kinds of studies will be stressed. This is when you would put emphasis on Tanakh in terms of its poetry, the Hebrew language, Jewish history, you know, things of that nature, plus, of course, the secular subjects, and a little bit of Gemara. This happened in Germany 50 years before that, but eventually there's no Gemara, as you know. And eventually nobody's from. Certainly, although it pays lip service to fundamentalism, it didn't take that long for fundamentalism to go out the window. These maskilim had no hesitation of taking advantage of the opportunity the government offered them, and a whole network of Jewish public schools, can I call them that? Jewish schools were opened all over Western Russia, Belarus and Lithuania and places like that, and Ukraine. The Jewish communities themselves were forced by the government to pay for these schools, and these are jobs. So if you're a maskil, you don't have a job, because how would you have one? Now you're a principal, now you're a teacher, now you're a school administrator, you get a salary. And so it was very insidious. The Frum community wasn't exactly sure how to react to this, except they were really angry. This, my friends, was the condition of Jewish life in the 1830s, 1840s, and 1850s in Russia. And that's exactly the lifetime of Yitzhak Volozhiner. Now, if he was in a funny situation, and this is the point I wanted to stress today. I can't give a whole long, as you can see, all these people I'm talking about are consequential individuals, and if you want to do it right, it would take hours. But just very briefly, people who have formal public positions, like Rabbi Yitzhak Volozhiner, but or the chief rabbis of old, they were in a uniquely vulnerable situation because the government knew that they are key individuals. So if you twist their arm, it's not so hard to twist the arm of a single individual. If you twist his arm, you'll get him to say what you want, and then that'll force all the others to line up in line. Because look, the big rabbi said it. You know, Moshe Feinstein said it. So how can you go against me? Rabbi Volozhiner said it. So the government was really pressuring him all the time to go along with the maskilic programs, to agree with the change of education, to do this, to do that. And he couldn't say, which he would like to say, which is drop dead twice. He can't say that. That's not the cards he has. And so, to some degree or another, he was forced, willy-nilly, against his will, to kind of go along, even though it was clear to everybody that's being done under extreme duress. It reminds me of the Noda Bihuda back in the early 1780s, when he faced the same situation where the Austrian government knew he's the big rabbi, and they kind of twisted his arm to agree to the opening of a Jewish public school, even though it was clear he didn't want to do it. And Rabbi Yitzhak Volozhiner found himself in this situation. Since he represented the status quo, the Jewish communities had a lot of, what shall I say, property is not the right word, but a lot of things, institutions mm-hmm. that were there, and he didn't want them to be destroyed or overthrown. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, you know, he tried to, you know, split the difference, to compromise, to save the best he could, and it was a very uncomfortable situation to be. Everybody among the Misnagdim knew the guy's trying his best. This, and they understood he's a tragic figure because he's put in a bad spot. He's not the only one. Rousseau Salanter, perhaps you may recall, was pressured by the government to become a professor in Talmud in one of those rabbinical seminaries that the government set up. It was a full court press by Nicholas I and his minister, Count Uvara was the guy's name, to try to co-opt the Jewish communal leadership to get them to agree to implement changes that these rabbis themselves were fundamentally convinced were hostile to the perpetuation of traditional Judaism. And this was the situation they found themselves in. And so in the 1830s, and especially in the 1840s, this may have killed them, by the way, 1840s, when these programs of the government were really in full swing, he was under tremendous stress. First of all, let's be honest, running a Volozhin yeshiva was a full-time business, agreed? Some say he doubled the number of students from 100 to 200. Others, I saw, say cut in half from 100 to 55. It doesn't matter. Yeshiva, especially with big Talmidei Chachamim, that's a place that requires, what's the right word, tipul b'talmidim. Do you know who were talmidim of Rabbi Yitzchak Volozhin? Dar HaShochan, for example, you know, people like that. Shmuel Molivar, I mean, some big names. These are serious. His students became leading gedolim in next generation. Just think of Aruch HaShulchan or somebody, you know, just off the top of your head. So that means you got to give a shiur all the time, and you got to, you know, and he even gave a shiur in Chumash and things like that. Additionally, Gemara, running yeshiva itself is full time, and then to be the administrator of the yeshiva, in addition to what I just told you, is a tremendous burden. Because especially if more students came, you got to raise money in those days. So how do you do that? You got to kiss up to all the rich and maintain constant correspondence. It's a killer job. Now, in addition to what I just said, let me throw in that he was the rav of the community. And it's never easy in Russia to be the rabbi of a Jewish community with all the local sichsuchim and fights. I won't go into that this time. I could do that another year. And then in addition to that, to have to deal with intra-Jewish, intra-communal problems of the Jewish people versus the Tsarist regime. I mean, just consider what I just said. And it's very well known that he was always under constant pressure, and the real Frum thought he's too yielding and too giving. There are stories that he had fights with Rizal Salanter over this. And of course, the left wing thought he's not sufficiently flexible. And that's the trouble of being somebody in the middle, the holding the responsibility. I would imagine it killed him, but I don't know that for sure. He was 69 when he died, so you can't tell. I'll share something very interesting. One of the schemes the Russian government came up with in the 1840s was to introduce a certain type of Reform Judaism, a certain type, very mild form of Reform Judaism in the Russian Empire by getting a rabbi, a German rabbi, who was officially Orthodox, but really was a left-winger. And, today it would be like open Orthodox or something. And to bring him to Russia and put him in charge of all Jewish education, all the schools, and persuade the Jews that it's in their own interest to switch all the cheders and yeshivas for, you know, Beth Tefillahs and Hebrew college type educations. This was the grand scheme. The name of the rabbi was Max Lilienthal. As I said before, he's a guy who was from Germany. He went a few years to yeshiva in Germany, but mainly he wasn't so from. But he was from enough to, for them to say, we got an Orthodox rabbi. And which, of course, is never really the case. And they brought him to Russia in the early 1840s. It's a long story. And he tried to persuade the Russian Jews to switch to chinuch. They called him into a room in a couple places. So, you crazy, don't you realize you're like a Judenrat? The government is using you as a traitor. It's not exactly clear if this made an impression, although he does write about it. If you're interested in the subject at all, memoirs are unbelievable, Max Lilienthal, because he describes life in the Russian Empire back in the 1840s, which is not so common to see, and in English. I remember that what happened was that he was there for a couple of years, and then he left because he saw the whole thing's not working out, and he eventually came to New York, where he started as an Orthodox rabbi, but by the time he moved from New York to Cincinnati, he became a Reform rabbi. He's one of the early Reform rabbis. And he wrote a long article in the American Jewish newspaper of that time, The Occident, from Isaac Leeser, in which he describes, it's very, very interesting. He describes life in Russia and the different groups, and the Misnagdim and the Hasidim. He calls them the Schneerson group. And it's just very, very interesting. In addition to that, a big Reform rabbi named Philipson, if I remember, David Philipson, was a real piece of work. I'm going by memory. I haven't seen this in about 40 years. I think in the Hebrew Union College Annual of 1915, I think, around then, he published a whole bunch of unpublished memoirs of this Max Lilienthal, like an autobiography of when he was in Russia. And one of the places this Max, in English, and one of the places he went to was Volozhin, where he met with Rabbi Yitzchak Volozhiner, and he tried to persuade him. And I remember it was like Yom Kippur, and Rabbi Yitzchak Volozhiner took him to the mikvah, and all kinds of stories. And you see that Rabbi Yitzchak Volozhiner is looking at him like a potential police spy, and he's being very, very diplomatic, trying to avoid this particular gezeirah. What can I tell you? He did the best he could. They couldn't overthrow the government, so the pressure was on there. I'll say this. During the reign of Nicholas I, for the most part, the Haskalah and these kinds of threats were a small group that were trying to implant themselves within the large Orthodox masses. And so the public looked at them by and large as traitors, and the effort to convert the masses away from Gemara was not so successful, because every push produces a counter-reaction. But things changed afterwards. If I can do this, I bet you many of you are familiar with the Nefesh HaChayim from Chaim Volozhiner, who talks about the sin of Adam and Eve. How's it go now? And he says, before they ate the apple, so the chait was external to them. The Yetzirah was outside of them. But after, so you could have Bechira, but it wasn't within you. But after they ate the apple or whatever it was, then the Yetzirah is within you. And then we deal with the situation we have today. You have the Yetzirah inside of you. So you remember that? I'm sure many of you know what I'm talking about. It's like one of the most famous pieces. And similarly, in the time of Yitzchak Volozhiner, he was successful enough to holding the Frum together that the Haskalah that I'm describing, the anti-Frum one, was external to the masses. But after his death, it became internalized. And the Haskalah assumed a different form in the middle of the 19th century. Less traitorous to the Jewish people. It's a very complicated process, but I'm just dumbing it down. And it became something internal to the Eastern European Jewry and caused a lot more trouble to the yeshivas after his time, frankly. So I'm describing a person who almost carried a very heavy burden and fought a heroic fight. There's a famous story, for example, that he was called in 1843, I think it was, by the government, by Lilienthal, to St. Petersburg, together with the Lubavitch Rebbe and the leader of the Maskilim, like a three-man commission, that they should agree to issue a statement that they support the Haskalah. This is so typical. They're calling in three big Frum rabbis, including the Lubavitch Rebbe of all people, that they should sign an announcement that they support Reform Judaism, essentially, that they should switch the cheders to these new schools. They should switch, listen to this, from Chumash and Rashi to Chumash and Mendelssohn, I kid you not, and similar things. Now, this is so transparent. You understand? Everybody can tell that even if they sign it, they don't mean it. It's being done under duress. The Tsar is saying, do you agree? This was a very difficult episode. I don't think it came out great. Because everybody had to sign in the end. But the Lubavitchers put out a story now, because everybody, when you talk about the past, it becomes very, well, my team versus your team, everybody lies. And so I remember I read a story, I think they have something to the effect that the Tzemach Tzedek, Lubavitcher, he held out, but the Rizzo Volozhiner, he gave in. But there are other places which said the Lubavitcher, he also signed something like that. All that misses the point. That's a tit for tat. What's really going on is, in these dictator regimes, they look for the forms and for somehow or other to get you to say that this is what you think is good enough for them. Stalin operated this way also. It's a little bit like those forced confessions from pre-modern law when they used to torture people.
So yes, they could get all the rabbis to say, yeah, we support getting rid of the yeshivas. Yes, we support getting rid of the cheders. Everybody knew they didn't mean it. And therefore, the fact that they came out with these decrees and formally, announced themselves that they want to have a renaissance of Jewish life and, you know, bring it more into modernity, and they love Russia and they love the Tsar. You know what it is. You know, it's obviously false. But welcome to Russia, my friends. So I've spoken long enough. If you look up, or everyone rethink, by Yitzhak Blazhner, this is a precious type in Jewish history. The responsible leader who's not able to do something stupid because he knows he has on his shoulders the burdens of the klal. We don't have too many people like that. And many times, like Yitzhak Blazhner, they don't have the limelight so much. People are more interested in people that do wild and daring and controversial things. What about the person who says, I can't afford to do something controversial? After misyashev, have to think, have to weigh everything out, because so much of the klal is dependent on my decisions. That'll be enough for now. Went too long anyway. Bye.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidovidkatz.com.